Thank you, Craig. My name is Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic. I'm just delighted to be here. It's been a wonderful conference. I could go home right now and have a lot more than I came with, although I probably couldn't get anybody to take me to the airport right now. But it's just been wonderful. I want to thank Burns for calling me and for the committee for inviting me. But mostly the people who came here, just for being so doggone nice to me. I'm not used to that. I don't know how many years it takes us to get used to people being nice to us, but it's difficult for me, and you've been most gracious, and I really want to thank you. I want to thank a lot of friends, people I've known, Herb, the old-timer, and Bill and Bonnie, and Sarah's dad, Pat from Columbus. You know, people that I've known, for many of them, for a number of years, and it's always good to see old friends. I want to thank the other speakers. My dear friend Mike is my oldest friend in Alcoholics Anonymous. Or no, I say that differently. I've known Mike longer than anybody else I know in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have been dear friends for many, many years. And we're friends the way people were friends on a spiritual journey. Sally and Albert, I've known for many years now, and Julia and I love them so very much. They've always sort of been an example to me, and I guess what I like most about Albert was he got sober in 1973, and I did too, so we're the vintage class of 1973, and we both probably had about the same chance of making it, and we did anyway. I want to thank my home group, who lets me come out and do these things. That's the cornerstone group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet Wednesday night and behind the Baptist Church in Wilmington, North Carolina at 8 o'clock. And if you're ever in Wilmington, North Carolina on Wednesday night at 8 o'clock, we hope you'll come. And we don't know if we're the best group or not. We don't get involved in contention or in competition, but it's an awfully good group with a lot of nice people. Mary Libb is one of the cornerstones of our group, and she's from Texas and a good friend of Sally's and Albert's. And I most of all want to thank my wife, Julia, who is at this moment praying for me. She always prays the hour that I talk. And she does. And I can't tell you what that means to me. When you're married in spiritual programs like Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, then it has a lot more to do than the physical things. And we're joined spiritually, and that's the great strength in my life. And I really do appreciate her. And when Burns called me and asked me to come and speak, I said to Julia, I said, the 20th is our wedding anniversary, and I'll be home late the night of the 19th. Is that okay with you? And she said, without Alcoholics Anonymous, we wouldn't have a wedding anniversary. And I really appreciate that from her. And so I've got something very special planned for Monday. And I'm just so grateful to be married to her. And I'd like to also, thanking everybody, I'd like to thank my sponsors. In Texas, if you heard Albert, they have a nice way of introducing themselves. They'll say, my name is Keith, and I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of God, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and three extremely mean sponsors, I have not found it necessary to take a drink since May the 13th, 1973. And for that, I am grateful. And that's true. I've had three very mean sponsors. Mean sponsors are sponsors who have standards that they expect you to live up to, and they live up to them. If you're kind of new, and I know we have a lot of new folks here, I've had the pleasure of meeting some of them. Burns took us over to the healing place, and then I met some of the ladies who were here from their center, and I want to say welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're very, very welcome here, and we very much need you here. But if you're like me, you need to be here more than we need you here. So my hope is you'll keep coming back. Also, if you're like me, you're probably tired of people treating you like you're a newcomer. Isn't that right? And I remember saying to my first sponsor, Dan, I said, Dan, when will I stop being a newcomer? And he said, when you stop getting mad every time somebody says newcomer. And about a week later, we're driving to a meeting, and I said, Dan, I hope Bill's there. And he said, well, who's Bill? I said, Bill was a new guy last week. It was his first meeting. And I said, every day this week when I've said my prayers in the morning, I've asked God to keep Bill sober. And he looked at me and smiled, and he said, you're no longer a newcomer. And so if today a thought of another human being has crept into your mind, then you don't have to be a newcomer anymore. You know, because what this is all about, of course, is caring about the next person to come along. What I was supposed to do here is I was supposed to tell you a little bit about what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like now. And I was born in Ohio, on the Ohio River, a small town called Martins Ferry. If you haven't been there, I wouldn't bother. I think it's been canceled. I'm not sure, but and I'm Irish, and I have 10 brothers and sisters, and I won't tell you what church I went to. I'll make you guess, but I'll give you a hint. It has something to do with bingo, but I'm not going to go any further than that. And I grew up in what I thought was poverty, and of course I was wrong about that. You know, I wasn't in Alcoholics Anonymous very long, and I used to go to the old-timers and whine to them a lot. And the guys would send me to the old-timers. We'd have a question or something, and they'd send me to get an answer. And if you're kind of new, I'd like to warn you about the old-timers. You'll hear people stand up here and say a lot of nice things about them, guys like Mike and Herb and some of them. But I'd like to caution you about old-timers. It's just a suggestion like the rest of the program, but if I were you, I'd stay away from old-timers. And I'll tell you why. Well, they lie. That's why. They say things like, you know, I come to AA because I need to. That's just a lie. They don't need to come to AA anymore. The only reason they come to AA is the only enjoyment they get out of living is watching people like you and me suffer. That's true, and that's why they come to AA. And if you don't believe me, find one of them after a meeting. Find an old-timer and tell them a problem. The first thing they do is laugh. You know. If you really want to make their day, tell them a problem about sex. They love problems about sex. I went to one, I was sober about 3 months, and I was sexually impotent, which will really put a crimp in your sex life. And I made a mistake of going to an old-timer, and he just had the best time. He burst into laughter and everything. And then he said, oh, it'll be all right. I said, well, when? I thought it was important. And he said, what, you got a full social calendar? You know. And they always say the same thing about sex. All the old-timers say the same thing. They say, no sex. They're not having sex anymore, and they don't want us to have sex either. Anyway, I went to this old-timer, and I forget what the problem was, but it was the problem of the month. And he told me, he said, I'd like to make a suggestion. I said, of course. He said, I'd like you to borrow some lipstick from one of the girls in the program. He said, I don't want you doing anything else with the girls in the program. And he said, oh, that's right, you can't. And he said, but I want you to borrow some lipstick from some of the girls in the program. He said, I want you to go home and write on the mirror, Keith, you were wrong. He said, write it on the mirror, Keith, you were wrong. I said, well, I can't do that. You see, my problem is that I have a poor self-image, and I need to be affirmed. Don't ever talk that way to an old-timer. They hadn't read any of those books. So I went and bought a tube of lipstick. I didn't want to owe anybody anything, especially a woman. So I went and bought a tube, and I went home, and I wrote on the mirror and said, Keith, you were wrong. And you know, I was disgusted. I thought, these people are crazy. I threw it in a trash can, and I went off to bed. It was a normal night. Remember 45 days? It was a normal night, you know? You know, I lay down and closed my eyes, and for the first time that day, my mind woke up. And it took off, boom, and it was, you're never going to make it, and you're going to be poor the rest of your life, and they're going to fire you, and you're going to be alone. What difference does it make? You're impotent, and, you know, just on and on, you know, tossing and turning, and finally I drift off to sleep, and then the leg cramps. Remember the leg cramps? Oh, you know, I'd just be jumping up and down next to my bed, wondering how I got there. My legs would be cramped up, and then I'd go sit in a hot tub for a little while, and in about 15 minutes before I was supposed to wake up, I'd fall sound asleep. And it'd take like 3 alarm clocks to wake me up, and my mind was waiting for me to wake up, and it'd start again, and it'd say, you know, you're going to go to work today, and they're going to fire you because they're going to find out you don't know how to do your job, and what difference does it make? You're hopelessly in debt. Just, you know, normal morning. And I went out in the kitchen, and I made coffee, and I just felt like I wanted to cry. So depressed, you know. And I went in, and I looked at the mirror, and it said, Keith, you're wrong. I said, well, thank God, because if I'm right, I'm in a hell of a lot of trouble. And I found, and if you're kind of new around here, I'd like to suggest that the great gift of Alcoholics Anonymous is that you're going to find out you've been wrong about a lot of stuff. And it's hard sometimes to accept being wrong. But just think if we were right. I mean, how would you like to live in a world if you're right about it? It'd be a terrible place. And so the great gift is being wrong. And so for the last 23 years, I celebrated 23 years this past Monday. And for the last 23 years, the most exciting part about my life are the times I found out that I've been wrong about things. And so if you'll kind of focus on being wrong, it's a great thing. I sponsored a few guys when I lived in Fayetteville. And I told them that story, and they came back, and they said to me, and I said, you know, you're absolutely right, Keith, that really works. I said, you know, last week we went home and wrote on our mirror, Keith, you were wrong. What I remember growing up mostly is being afraid. I don't know if anybody here has ever experienced fear, but I sort of like grew up being afraid, and what that tells me is that I grew up with spiritual illness. I mean, long before I took a drink, I was spiritually ill because the book tells me that fear is one of the four horsemen, and that fear is a sign of spiritual illness, and so I was spiritually ill long before I ever took a drink, and I was fear, and I was filled with fear, and I was also a little kid who had a very bad speech impediment, and no one could understand anything that I said. And after I was sober a number of years, I discovered also that I was a very sickly child, and those are things that you tend to try to forget. And so it explained an awful lot of my life. I was a kid who had something lived under his bed. I don't know if you ever ran into that, but there were a lot of them in Ohio. But it was under my bed, and it would come out when the lights were out. And if you pressed your ear against the mattress, you could hear it moving around down there. And I knew what it was there for. It was waiting for me to dangle my little legs over the side of the bed. And I was history. I knew that. I mean, there's some stuff a kid intuitively knows. And I also knew I couldn't talk about it. So I just lived with all these fears. I had a fear growing up. I said, I don't know what I want to be. I mean, I'm 5 years old, and I have no idea what I want to be. I had to get married, and I don't even like girls. And I don't know what I don't have a job. As a 5 years old, I spent a lot of time thinking about these things. And then I like to talk also about my first drinking experience. I think it's important to have a first drinking experience if you're going to be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've run into a few people I'm not sure has had one yet, but it's important, and I like to think about that. And I had my first real drinking experience when I was 5 years old. I was home. I didn't go out a lot when I was five, and my father was watching us. My mother was out. She was either at the bingo or having a baby or something, And I guess Dad thought it would be kind of cute. We're sitting around the kitchen table. It was my dad and my brother, Dumb Denny. He's a year younger than I am, and myself. And we're sitting around a table playing Cootie or some bug game or something. And he thought it would be funny. And he got us each a beer. And I drank mine, and nothing happened. Very unimpressed. But Denny was having a spiritual awakening. I looked over, and old Dumb Denny was sliding out of the chair, and he was rolling around under the table, and he was singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and other drinking songs, and my father kind of panicked, and he wrestled poor Dumb Denny to the ground. He got his clothes off, and he put his jammies on him, and he carried him upstairs to put him in his little bed, and he said to me, get ready for bed, son. And I said, okay, Dad. So I went up and got ready for bed, and Denny was laughing and singing and carrying on, and Dad said, look, try to go right to sleep and don't say anything to your mom and I'll take you to the movies. Well, I was game. You know, when you're five, they don't negotiate with you a lot. But Den wasn't hearing it. He was just having the best time. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. Old Denny stood up and urinated on the bedroom floor. And I remember watching this thinking, you know, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. And, you know, the strangest thing happened. Danny just never developed. It's like he fell apart like a cheap suit. He went on and did some strange things. We're not proud of this, but the truth is the truth. Danny, I'll tell you some of the weird things he did. Danny grew up and he went to one college. Oh, it gets worse. He had one major. And he graduated in 4 years. Went to one graduate school. Graduated on time. They offered him like 8 jobs. He took one. And now he's a senior vice president in a large international corporation. He's been with him for years. The strangest thing of all was he married one woman. Now here's a guy who had the world in the palm of his hands when he was 4 years old, and he just let it slip through his fingers, you know? I had to work at this thing. I was 23 years old before I urinated on a bedroom floor for the first time. I've always been frightened by spiritual people and spiritual things, and a lot of times I would call it embarrassment. But it really wasn't embarrassment, it was really frightened. I remember I went to a Catholic high school, and a few years ago my wife Julie and I were up, and I took her by the old school and showed it to her, and it's a very small little school, and I took her up to the library, and there's a small little library, and really a tiny little room, and not very many books, and... But the woman who held sway over that library was a little nun named Sister Victoria. And Sister Victoria was an extraordinary human being, and she was a happy person. And she would run around saying strange things like, you know, every boy's a prince and every girl's a princess because we have a father who's a king. And of course, when you're a little kid and you're spiritually ill, you're frightened by things like that. So we would ridicule her and make fun of her and call her names and things. And the other thing that... that Sister Victoria did was she watched us, and we did our detention in the library. I spent a lot of time with Sister Victoria because I had some real developmental problems. If we'd have had money, I would have been an acting out adolescent, but we were poor, so I was just a punk. And they put me in the library, and what we had to do was make rosary beads. You know, those are the things that Catholics pray on all the time. And she put me behind the magazine rack. She said I was a prince, but I was a contagious prince. So she put me behind the magazine rack, and I'd make rosary beads. And you'd get wire and beads and a little pair of pliers. You'd make these rosary beads. Then they would send them to the missions. And I made rosary beads instead of with 10 beads in each decade. I made them with 11 beads in each decade. And I made hundreds of mutant rosary beads over the years. And they would send them out all over the world to all their missions. And it came time to graduate, and this dumb nun hadn't caught on yet. So she said to me, I said, Sister, you know what I've been doing the last 4 years? She said, yes, you sly little prince. I know what you've been doing. You've been putting extra beads in all the decades of the rosary. And she said, I also know why you've been doing it. And I remember thinking, I hope she tells me why I've been doing it, because I have the foggiest notion of why I do these things. And she said, you've been doing it so that people all over the world will pray extra prayers, and God is going to give you all the credit. Don't you just hate people like that, you know? And then she did a thing that just terrified me. She took both of my hands in her hands, and she said, you're a very, very special little prince. She said, when I first met you, I knew you were special. And she said, so I put this on my beads. You know, they used to wear those long beads that bang against the desk when you're taking your test. And she put a medal on, a medal of St. Jude, who's the patron saint of lost causes. And she said, whenever I pray my beads, I come to this, I say a prayer for you. She said, because one day, you're going to go all over the world telling God's children how very much he loves them. And it terrified me. I was a little kid with a speech impediment, and I didn't want to be heard and couldn't be understood. And I remember leaving that library that day and not wanting no part of it because I was afraid. I forget to tell you, you know, God loves you, and it's the proof is you're here. I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up, so I thought you had to go away. Because if you go away, they don't know you don't know what you want to be. They'll think you're on your way to doing it. So I went away, and I took an inventory. The only way you could go away when you're like me back then was to go to the military. And back then it wasn't a question of if you were going to the military, it was where and when. Those were the questions. And so I took one of my very first inventories. I took my shirt off and I stood in front of the mirror and I flexed my muscles and I turned sideways and stuck my chest out and everything. And I was 5 feet 1 inches tall and I weighed 113 pounds. And whatever else I was a born killer. So I went over to Wheeling, West Virginia, and joined the Marine Corps. And the recruiter, I wasn't yet 18, so my parents had to sign for me. And I forgot to tell them what I was doing. And the recruiter showed up at our house with these papers. And my father said, "Are you sure you want to do this?" And I said, "Yeah, I really do." So they signed under mild protest. And that night, I got a real view of my parents' opinion of my potential. My mother cried all night, and she said, "Scott, they'll kill him." And my dad kept saying, "Don't worry, Pat, they won't take him." So the next morning I got up, and we took a taxi cab, over to Wheeling, and they put me on a Greyhound bus. And I went to Pittsburgh. It's 60 miles away, and it's the second longest trip I'd ever been on in my life. And I got up there, and it was a very bad year. And if you had a pulse, they took you. And I had a pulse. So that afternoon, they swore me into the Marine Corps. And I tell you, I was terrified. I didn't know a thing about the Marine Corps. The only thing I knew was they took a certain number of people to South Carolina and drowned them in a swamp. That's the only thing I knew about the Marine Corps. And there were three guys from Pittsburgh who joined, and so they said to me, "Look, we've got about 8 hours till the train leaves. We're going to go over and get a sandwich and a few beers. You want to come along?" And I said, "Yeah, what do I know? I'm from out of town." And so I followed them over to this place, and that's the night my life changed. And if you're alcoholic, you know exactly what I mean. That's the day that I had an awakening that would alter the way I lived the rest of my life. We went into a bar. I don't know where the bar is. I couldn't take you there today, but I know that it was a bar, and I looked around. I walked in there, and the bar was just filled with real men. You know the kind, and all of them had real women with them. Real women hang around with real men, and guys like me used to get what was left. And I looked around, and I was terrified. And we went over and sat down, and this bartender came over. He is a real man, and he said, "What do you want?" And I thought, oh no, a quiz. I sort of had the feeling that when you went through life, when you least expected it, somebody would walk up and say, "Take out a blank sheet of paper, put your name in the upper left-hand corner," and it'd ask you a lot of questions that I didn't have answers for. I mean, I knew a lot of answers, but I never studied the right stuff. That's the way it was with life, and I didn't know what to say, so I did what I usually did. I watched what the other guys said, and then I said what they said. And they said a beer, so I ordered a beer. And then the guy came back. He asked the same question, and they gave the same answer, so I did too. And then he came back the third time, and by this time I knew the answer. And I answered first. I said, "Give us four more beers." My voice cracked or something. And then it happened for me. And if you're alcoholic, you know what it is. My life changed in an instant. Between the second and third drink, everything that I'd ever wanted to be, I was. I stood up that night in that bar in Pittsburgh, and I looked down, and the floor was 6 feet 4 inches below me, and my right shoulder was out to there, and my left shoulder was out to there, and the muscles were rippling through my body and pulling at my shirt and things. And in that mind, it had been filled with fear and terror and doubt. All of a sudden, like, boom, it was crystal clear. And for the first time in my life, I understood the big picture. And I remember just saying, "But of course, it's so simple. Why couldn't I see it before? It's so simple." And then I looked around, and my heart broke, because that place was filled with a bunch of pathetic, snivelling little men. And all of them had women with them, or looking at me with their hungry eyes. You know how they do it. And they were saying things like, "I'd give anything if I could have a man like that." And the people were so filled with questions, and they were so lost. And I spent the rest of the night just going from table to table, filling them in on things. I mean, I explained to them about God. I explained to them about growing up. I explained to them about being a real man. I was giving them answers to questions they hadn't come up with yet. It was absolutely magnificent. It was the greatest night of my life up until that time. And the guy said to me, he said, "We better go. We have to catch the train." And it seemed to me that the people were saying, "Please don't go. We've just discovered you. You know. And I said, oh, now I have to go and make the world safe for democracy. And I went out and I got on a train, and the Marine Corps provided me with a Pullman coach, and it's very nice of them. And I don't remember getting in the Pullman coach, but I do remember waking up on the floor of the Pullman coach, and someone had wet the floor I was lying on. And whoever it was, they had wet me too. And so I got up and changed my clothes, and I discovered that I was in Washington, D.C., which is three times as far from home as I'd ever been. And again, I was little and skinny and frightened. And I got off the train, and the guys are waiting on the platform, and they said, we're going to go over to the Monaco and have a few drinks for breakfast. You want to come along? And I figured, what do I know? I'm from out of town. So I followed them over there, and the same thing happened. And that night, I fell off the train in a place called Yamasee, South Carolina. It was somebody moved the bottom step or something, and I fell across the next set of railroad tracks. And there was a very rude man there. They had sent to greet us, and he was hurling obscenities at myself and the other men who'd gone down there to die for their country. And I got up and I brushed myself off and I tried to explain to this cretin that he would probably get a lot further with us if he treated us with a little respect. But he never seemed to catch on to what it was I was saying. It was like he wouldn't stop screaming long enough to really hear me. They say you can learn from every experience. And I'll tell you what I learned from that experience was you can do a lot of push-ups drunk. That's what I learned. You know, you can do push-ups and throw up at the same time, too, you know. They also told me that, you know, there's something to be grateful for in everything. And I guess what I'm grateful for is he didn't have me doing sit-ups, because that would have been a real mess, I can tell you that. So I was launched into the Marine Corps, and I loved the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps made sense to me. It really did. I mean, for the very first time in my life, I knew exactly what was expected of me. And it may sound strange to you, but I never knew what was expected of me. I mean, life seemed to be a code that I couldn't crack. And all of a sudden, I'm in there, and they said, today we run 5 miles. Well, that makes sense to me. I can get 5 miles if I know that's what's expected. And so I threw myself into the Marine Corps, and I loved everything about it. And you know, and I grew a few inches, and I packed on about 25 or 30 pounds. And I graduated from boot camp with Dress Blues Award and Outstanding Man's Award. And I went on, and I was going to spend the next 100 years in the Marine Corps if they'd keep me. That's just how I thought about it. I loved everything about it. Every promotion I got was a meritorious promotion. And I decided I was the youngest NCO in the Marine Corps, and I was going to be the youngest officer. And I went to work, and I got an appointment to go to Officer's Candidate School. The problem I had was that I was alcoholic. And let me tell you what it means to me to be alcoholic. I mean, we hear all these horror stories, and I certainly had my horror story. But the bottom line for me is this. Being an alcoholic means that I will absolutely fall in love with the way of life. I'll love everything about it. And I'll throw myself into it with the fervor of a martyr. And then I'll begin to violate virtually every principle associated with that way of life. And eventually, I'll have to leave that, and I'll have to blame them for what happened to me. And that's alcoholism. Now, at the end of four years, I had so muddy the waters. I had violated virtually every principle associated with being a Marine. The final thing was I led a combat patrol in a blackout. I don't remember going out, and I don't remember coming back. We took fire, and we returned fire, and I don't remember a thing. And it's hard to fill out a report the next morning when you don't know where you've been or what you've done. And by the grace of God, no one was hurt, at least on our side. And it just terrified me. And I went back and turned down a commission and got out. And I blamed the Marine Corps for what happened. And that's my alcoholism. I mean, I went and was in a steel mill for a little while, did exactly the same thing. And then I got on a bus one night and ran from home to Maryland. And I began a search. A search that became more and more frantic. I went and lived in a Jesuit theologian. That's a place where people study theology to become priests. And I was working for a man who had a laboratory there. And I remember the nights I'd walk through the library and just know that somewhere in that massive number of books in Latin and Greek and English and everything else, somewhere in those books were an answer that would take care of that stuff that always went on inside of me, that all those voices that went on in there to tell me who I was or who I wasn't and what I was doing and what I wasn't doing and why I wouldn't measure up and why God didn't want anything to do with me. And And I did the same thing with marriage. I watched my mother and father be married. And they're married 55 years. My mother is very ill now and probably won't be with us much longer. But I watched her parent, and I watched my father parent. And they raised 11 of their own children, and then they raised some kids who didn't have any place else to go. And we used to jokingly say, you have to get home early, because if you don't get home in time, somebody will take your spot in bed. And because, you know, if there are little kids around who didn't have places to go, or the parents were drunk or something like that, they just stayed with us. My parents celebrated 50 years of being married 5 years ago. And people came from all over the country, kids who they had raised. It's an astounding phenomenon. So I knew about being married, and I knew about being a parent. And I did with that what I did with the Marine Corps, what I did with everything else, and indeed what I knew I had to do because I was an alcoholic. I got married and threw myself into it, and I threw myself into parenting. And before it was over, I had violated virtually every principle associated with being married. I violated every trust. I was a lousy parent. I ended up leaving a four-month-old daughter who I loved as much as Peter loved the Lord. I left her in a crib because I needed to go get a drink. My second daughter was born, Kimberly, and she had a horrible case of hyaline membrane disease. And in fact, it's a pretty common thing now, but back then, the first hospital on the East Coast, Georgetown University Hospital, where I worked, had the very first negative respirator. And it was bought it was delivered a few days before she was born, and it was put together the day before she was born by an engineer and a resident who I'd gone to high school with. And so when she was born, it was there for her. She weighed a pound and a half, and she was almost 3 months premature. And I discovered the kind of parent I had developed into. Our offices were across from the neonatal nursery, and I didn't drink those nights. But I sat in that office with the lights out and the door slightly cracked, and I watched my little girl fight for every breath. And they told me that if she lives, they didn't think she would live, but if she did live, she'd probably be retarded. And the little girl frightened me. And they like parents to go in and touch the children and bond with them and everything. And I was afraid to do that because by this time in my life, it appeared to me that if God found out I liked something, he took it away from me. Everything I ever wanted was slipping away from me. And I thought, if God finds out I want her to be alive, he'll kill her. And I sat in that office and watched this. And at 72 hours, it's a very critical time for these little children. And I was there the night that my wife came down the hall, and she had a 1,000-yard stare. She was like a zombie at this time. And she went in and baptized our little angel because I didn't think she'd live through the night. And, you know, everything inside of me wanted to run in there and grab the two of them and say, we'll do this together. We're a family. And I couldn't. I couldn't. I was completely incapable by that time in my life of being anything I wanted to be. And I went down to a chapel in the hospital that night, and I got on my knees in front of the tabernacle. And if you're a Catholic, that's a big thing. And I begged God to let her live. I said, if you let her live, I won't drink. And I was drunk in less than 24 hours. I know I'm powerless over alcohol. And you know, the sickest thing of all, the spiritual illness was so great that I really believed that the God who carved me in the palm of his hand, the God who knit me in his mother's womb, would kill a pound and a half year old girl because her father was so sick that he had to drink. That's the tragedy of alcoholism. That's the tragedy. And of course, God is God and not me. And God has plans for all of us. And that little girl lived. And as a matter of fact, she's 26 years old. She graduated from Auburn as an honor student, and she's an educator and all sorts of things. God didn't kill her because her father was sick. And I thought he would. And people wondered why I was religiously anti-religious when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I was afraid of God and afraid of what God would do. You know, if you're living like that, a marriage won't last long. And one day my wife finally asked me to leave. And it was interesting. By then there was no fight left. And I just left. And I went to where I needed to go, which was the basement of a dive in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C. And I only lasted about 6 months on my own. That woman had me propped up fairly well. And at the end of 6 months, I went into what passed as a bathroom. And I had enough pills in there to kill me and half a dozen other people. I never took pills. I worked in hospitals, and anybody who worked in hospitals, you know, 20-some years ago, they used to give away stuff. You know, they get it right out of the brewer and give it away. You have tranquilizers and all sorts of stuff, and Placidil and everything. And I had a whole medicine cabinet full of this stuff, and I never took it. I was afraid of it. There are people in this room who think that's the saddest story they ever heard, but I just never took them, and I decided I would. I just decided I'd die, and it's amazing to me. People always say they're amazed that people commit suicide. I'm amazed that more alcoholics don't, because it was just the next thing. It was no bigger a deal than taking a morning drink. It was no bigger a deal than stealing to buy some booze. It was just the next thing. And it was not a lot of emotion involved with it. And that's the frightening thing about it. And that's why I know that being sober is a miracle of God. Because anything that could stop that march to death, it's got to be a miracle. And I stood in front of the mirror and I made a statement out loud. I said, "You're 29 years old and at least it'll be over." And a voice, a very clear, distinct, crystal clear voice, a woman's voice, said to me, "When you're 29, it's not supposed to be over." And I was so startled. And I had a clear thought. And I remembered that my ex-wife had given me a couple phone numbers when I left. And it turned out that one was to Alcoholics Anonymous and one was to a little treatment center. I went out to the desk where they were, and the only one I could find turned out to be the one to the treatment center. You hear a lot of people from these podiums say a lot of things about treatment centers. I don't like to get involved in a controversy. What I do know is that if that place hadn't taken me, I don't think I'd be alive today. It's just that simple. I called them up, and they told me I could come there in 3 days. And back then, you couldn't get into a hospital. Burns remembers these times, I know. If you were an alcoholic, you couldn't get in a hospital. I was employee of the year at Georgetown University Hospital, and I couldn't have gone in that hospital with what I had. That's an amazing phenomenon, isn't it? But these people took me, and 3 days later, I somehow knew it was time. And I didn't drink for 3 days, and I heard stuff, and I saw things. And I heard Beethoven's Fifth Symphony for 2 days. It was coming out of the light switches. It would come out of the radiator of my car. And I was sitting in a bank. I had to go try to get a loan on this alcoholic car I had. I had to get $400 so I could get into this place. And I'm sitting in a bank listening to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And it suddenly occurred to me that they didn't have Muzak. I was the only person in the bank enjoying the symphony. And then the day came for me to go out there. And I got in this alcoholic car of mine, and I started to drive out there. It was 30 miles away. And it took me 5 hours to get there. I had what used to be called the running fits. Now they call them an anxiety attack. But they used to be called the running fits. And it was an incredible thing. I'd drive about a mile, and they would come over, and I'd begin to shake, and then I'd begin to sweat, and then I'd begin to cry. I'd just be terrified. And my heart would be jumping out of my throat. And I'd get the car off the side of the road, and I'd get out, and I'd try to walk around. And sometimes I'd run up and down a road, and I'd tremble, and I'd cry, and I'd wet my pants. And I'm changing my pants outside my car on Route 29 outside of Washington, D.C., and I wondered what had happened. What had happened? And my life was over. And what I wanted, and I need to remember this every day of my life, what I wanted, what I asked God that I didn't believe in for, was a place where He would put me where I wouldn't hurt myself and the people I loved anymore. And that's the deal I made when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really need to remember that deal. And somehow I got there, and I was many hours late, and they'd given my bed away because they didn't think I was coming, and they let me sleep on the sofa. And that night they took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know I existed. And they took me to that meeting, and I'll never forget it as long as I live. I walked up to the door, and very much like you, they had greeters who would shake your hand. And I really appreciate that now, but I didn't appreciate it then. I remember thinking, this old guy standing at the door, and he shook my hand, and he looked me in the eye. You know how obnoxious that is, you know? We just look you in the eye. And I was a shoe guy. I was looking at shoes. And any place I'd look, his head would be right there looking me in the eye. And he shook my hand. And he shook it firmly. I like hugging. I think hugging's nice. But the thing about handshakes I like is that you look one another in the eye. And there's something so special about that. But at any rate, he looked me in the eye and he said to me, "Oh, you're new, aren't you?" And I thought, "Oh, my God, he's psychic." And then he took me over and he introduced me to an old lady, and she sat down with me and patted me and got me a half a cup of coffee, and halfway through the meeting, she said, they stop the meeting and have a collection and things. And she turned and looked at me and smiled and says, "You know, son, you keep coming here. You never have to be alone again." And I began to cry. I swear to you, I didn't know that what I was alone. And I remember the nights I'd be laying next to this woman I was married to. It was like I was laying next to a perfect stranger. You remember the nights when, you know, you'd come in late and you'd take your clothes off and sneak into the bedroom and slip into bed and lay there perfectly still and not move. And she'd be laying there perfectly still and had been awake all night waiting for you to come home. And you'd lay there and feel a million miles away from one another. Then there were the nights that I couldn't sleep and I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober, and I'd get up and I'd walk down to the bedroom where the two little angels were, and I'd go in and I'd touch their little heads and things, and I knew that something that nice couldn't have anything to do with me. So I knew about being alone. I knew all about being alone. I belonged to a family who loved me very much but forgot to tell me when the family reunions were, because whenever I went there, there was always trouble. I was attached to nothing or no one. And I knew about being alone. And the man who led the meeting, it was a second step meeting, and he talked about insanity. And they read a thing called a preamble, and I heard the word fellowship, and I remember what a warm sense of thought of the word fellowship. And that began for me an odyssey which has been uninterrupted from that day until this one. And if you're kind of new and you haven't had a slip, you don't have to. I thought everybody slipped in Alcoholics Anonymous. It seemed to me that everybody slipped. I thought you had to slip. And I remember thinking to myself, well, if you're going to slip, you better get it over with, because then you can have long-term sobriety if you live. And so I'm going back and forth and back and forth. And finally, I said, I better talk to my sponsor about this. So I went to Dan, and I said, "Dan, when did you slip?" He said, "Well, I've never slipped." I said, "You mean you have to slip too?" And he said, "Of course not." He said, "I don't ever have to drink again." He said, "If I don't drink today, I never have to drink again." He said, "My sponsor, Matt, has never had a drink since he came to Alcoholics Anonymous." And then he started naming Art and Bill and all the people he started naming. He said, "They never had a drink since they came to Alcoholics Anonymous." I'll tell you, I was so overwhelmed with gratitude, I didn't have to slip, that I just felt great for the next week. It was a terrific thing. And you know, I got involved with you. And if you're new, please get involved with people. You don't have to like it. You don't have to enjoy it. And, you know, if you're afraid, you'll probably be angry about it. But do it anyway. I mean, how bad can it be? You know, they took me places. They took me to psychiatric hospitals. They took me places. And I got a sponsor. You know, I was looking around for the perfect sponsor. And I said to the old timer, this old timer said to me, he said, "You have a sponsor yet?" I said, "No." He said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, I'm trying to find someone I can relate to." That was real important in the 70s to relate. And he said, "Well, you want to find someone you relate to?" He said, "Go to a bar." He said, "Bars filled with people you can relate to." He said, "What you need to do is find a man you can be like if and when you grow up." Well, all right. So I looked around, and there were two guys who were living life the way I wanted to live it. And one's name was Dan, and the other's name was Art. And so I did this thing scientifically. I knew they both went to the same meeting. So I went to that meeting, and I sat in a chair, and I watched the door. And here they come together. And my thought was, the first one who walked in, I would ask him. And they come together. And just before they got to the door, somebody stopped Art to ask him a question. And poor Dan walked in. And he became it. And there began an odyssey for me. This whole thing about sponsorship. If you don't have a sponsor, find one. You're better off with a bad sponsor than no sponsor. Make sure they don't smell like alcohol. If they smell like alcohol, I wouldn't ask them. But if they're doing kind of stuff, if they look like they're having fun, if they have a smile on their face, if they look like they're enjoying life, ask them how they do it. They didn't come in here feeling that way. So they learned to do it in here. You know, and I was always afraid. I was always afraid of people in authority. And I resented them, but I was really afraid of them, because I wanted them to like me. I wanted them to pat me on the head and tell me I was doing good. And so I'd never talked to Dan about anything that was unpleasant, because I didn't think he wanted to sponsor someone who was having problems. So I'd always tell him the good stuff I was doing. And then, you know, one morning I got up and I got ready to go to work. This is a true story. If you're having thinking problems, please hang on to this, because, of course, you're having thinking problems. You may not be able to, huh? But I got ready to go to work one morning. I looked good. I had a coat and tie and everything. I went out and got in the car, and I started to drive, and the problem was I forgot where I worked. That's a terrible thing. I mean, you know, I was frantic. I was saying, "Where do I work? Where do I work?" And I always carried a card in my pocket with my sponsor's phone numbers, work and home, and a dime. He taped a dime to the card, and he said, "You ever need me, call me." And so I got the card out, and I called him from the phone booth.
And I don't know how to tell my sponsor that I forgot where I work because, you know, I thought they'd throw a net over me and take me away. Because you got to know, I secretly believed I was crazy. And so Dan answered the phone. I said, good morning, Dan. He said, morning, Keith. How are you? I said, I'm fine. I was just wondering how you are. He said, well, I'm fine. He said, what's all that noise? I said, well, I'm calling you from a phone booth. He said, your car break down? I said, no, Dan, car's fine. Car's fine. I just wonder how you are. And he paused and he said, what's the matter, buddy? I said, well, Dan, it's not a big problem. I just can't seem to remember where I work. You know what he said to me? He said, oh, you got the old I can't remember where I work problem, huh? He said, a lot of us have had that. I've been an Alcoholics Anonymous 23 years. I've never found another person who forgot where they work. But then he said the thing to me that mattered. The thing that mattered was this. He said, Keith, he said, it's very, very scary, isn't it? And he said, you know, you've done a lot of damage to your brain. He said, but what I know is that if you stick around Alcoholics Anonymous, it'll get better. And he said, we all have things like this. And he said, it just takes a while for things to get better. He said, I promise you. He said, I give you my word that your thinking's going to straighten out. And I said, you sure? He said, I'm positive. I said, okay. And he said, I'd like to make a suggestion. I said, anything. And he said, if you ever have this problem again, I'd like to suggest, if you can remember to look at the front bumper of your car, you have a parking sticker for the hospital. I remember thinking, where do these people learn these things? You know? Amazing. And then the night came that I had to tell Dan that I was experiencing sexual impotence. He hadn't been sober that long. He just smiled. He didn't laugh. And he said, you know, a lot of us have had that problem. And I said, really? He said, yep. And he said, you know, for most of us, it gets better. I said, well, when? And he said, well, let's look at it another way. And I said, you know, Dan, this looks like one of those either-or deals to me. And he said, well, maybe not, maybe not. He said, you got a lot of problems, don't you? I said, I got a lot of problems. And he said, every time somebody else has a problem, you have it too. I said, that's an amazing thing, isn't it? And he said, you probably have 100 problems. I said, I had thousands. He said, yeah, thousands of problems. And he said, of all the problems you have, he said, which one will be more fun to work on than this one? And that's what sponsors do. They put a smile on tragedy, see? And he also taught me how to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if nobody's teaching you how to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're missing the best part. I mean, how do you go to institutions? How do you go on 12-step calls? He took me on my first 12-step call. It was to the DCG. I'll never forget this as long as I live. And I'm going with my sponsor. I was the book man. I carried the book. And I had the book. And we go into the DC jail. And we go, and there's a guy behind the glass, and we're talking over the phone. He's talking to this guy, and the guy's talking. I can't hear a thing the guy's saying, but I can hear Dan. And Dan was a big guy. He was a calm man. He just was peaceful. He had an aura of peace about him. And at the very end, he said, I got a new guy with me. He said, Keith is doing really well. He said, he's been sober almost 3 months now. And he said, he's really doing well. I'm going to let him talk to you for a couple minutes. So he handed me the phone. And I had a lot to say to this guy. And I began to preach to him. And I was preaching really good. And finally, the guy stopped me. And he said, whoa, whoa, wait, buddy. He said, this stuff's fine for a cretin like you. He said, but I'm a Fulbright scholar. And I lost it. I just lost it. I began to scream in the phone, well, Mr. Fulbright scholar, one of us is leaving here in a few minutes and have dinner. The other one's going to go back to his cell in his wrinkled blue uniform, and they're going to slam the door on him. And Dan's trying to get the phone away from me. And by this time, I'm not finished. I'm down on the floor, and I got holding the phone with both hands. I'm screaming at this guy. And then pretty soon the guards came, and the other visitors came to see what was going on. And finally, Dan got the phone away from me, and he said to the guy, who by this time had stopped talking, he said to him, he said, I'll be back tomorrow to talk to you. He hung up the phone and we left. And I just knew I was going to be drummed out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew they were going to tear up my big book in front of the home group and send me out the door. I knew it, you know. We were walking across the parking lot and I said to Dan, I said, that's pretty bad, isn't it? And old Dan, he looked at me and smiled. He said, well, Keith, I'll be honest with you. He said, you know, most guys wouldn't have done it that way. He said, but you'll discover that you develop your own techniques in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's true. You know, I wanted to talk just a little bit about this whole business of self-will. You know, I made an awful lot of mistakes in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I made them because it was okay to be wrong. And the only mistake I don't have to make is drink. If I can not drink, I can probably overcome just about any mistake I can make. And I made a lot of them, because I tried to push the river. You know, I wanted to get back and finish my education, because I thought life was slipping by. And I was, all of a sudden, I was 30 years old. And so I went to the university, and I signed up for some courses, and I wrote a bad check to take some courses, and then I bought the books, and I went home, and I began to read the books, and I knew all the words, and no thoughts happened in my head. I was sober about 4 months, and I was terrified, and I finally called Dan, and I said, Dan, I said, I signed up for these courses, and I got these books, and I can't read them, I don't understand anything, and my mind's gone. And he said, wait, he said, why don't you talk to me about these things before you do it? He said, you're not ready. And he said, there are two things that are necessary. He said, one is a good idea, the second time is the right time. The second thing is the right time. He said, what you've got is a great idea. Your timing stinks. He said, you have to let God decide when these things happen. And I said to him, I said, okay, and what do you want me to do? He said, go back, drop the courses. He said, apologize to the university for writing them a bad check and keep the books. I said, keep the books? He said, keep the books. So I did what he said. 1 year later, my boss wanted to see me as chairman of the department. I knew what he wanted to see. They always want to see you to fire you. That's what they want to do. So I went to see, his name was Paul Bruns. Paul has passed away. And Paul said to me, he said, Keith, I've watched you the last year and a few months. And he said, I must say, I'm most impressed with what's happened to you since you started going to those meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, well, thank you. And he said, I can't give you a raise because there's a wage and price freeze in effect. He said, but what I can do is this. And he gave me a letter and I opened it and I had a tuition-free scholarship for 4 years to anything I wanted to do, medical school, anything I wanted to do at Georgetown University. And I was amazed. I was overwhelmed. And I went down to my office, and my boss came in, and he said, did Paul give you the letter? I said, he did. I said, I'm overwhelmed. And my boss said to me, he said, I'd like to give you these. And there were credits for books. He was a professor there, and every semester he'd get credits for so many books. And how many textbooks do you buy? And he had a lot of them. And you know, I never paid for a book going to college. And then the phone rang, and it was a little girl who worked over at the Veterans Administration office. And I had given her brother a job the summer that I got sober. He needed to work in a laboratory so he could go to Tufts undergraduate school to major in biology. And I'd given him the job, and she was grateful. And she called me up and said, I heard about your scholarship. I want to thank you. She said, also, I took the liberty of checking your veteran status. I said, well, it's expired. She said, today the president signs a bill that extends it. And if you can carry 12 hours and work full-time, you can make $300 a month going to school. You know, the only books I paid for were the books I did when I was working under self-will. So if you're kind of new and you're feeling like life's leaving you behind, don't. You know, I went on and studied what I wanted to study. I wanted to study philosophy and I wanted to study theology, and that's what I did. I've been most grateful for that ever since. You know, I wanted my social life. I wanted something to happen. I was sober a little while now, and I wanted to report that things were getting better. And I decided it was time for a relationship. And I did something that, if you look in the first page of my big book, there's something taped in the very first page. And I got it this night. I met a woman at the hospital, and I didn't check this out with my sponsor. I mean, after all, I'm sober about a year and a half now, and I know what's best for me. And I asked this woman out, and I took her to Chinatown, and I convinced her that a little warm sake wouldn't hurt her. And what I was trying to do was get her drunk enough to go to bed with me, because sober she'd never want to do it. I knew that. And I'm feeding this poor woman warm sake and telling her that it's just like tea and it won't bother you. And then, you know, they brought us fortune cookies after the meal, and I opened my fortune cookie, and my fortune cookie said, what sobriety conceals, drunkenness reveals. And I went and called my sponsor. And all Dan says was, you're where? You're doing what? He said, you get that girl home and you get your ass over here. I said, okay, Dan, okay. So I told him. So I'm driving this girl to her house and she's pulling out my clothes and everything. And sake works, in case you guys are... I told her, I said, I can't. My sponsor said I have to go over to his house. Tell you, the other thing that's in my big book is a cablegram. And I was sober about 5 years, and what happened to me in my sobriety was absolutely miraculous. But you know, it wasn't good enough. You know, it just wasn't good enough. And my pride was running wild. And Mike was a very important person to me in this part of my life, too. And I applied for a job. And had I gotten that job, it would have killed me. I would have been out of the country. I would have been away from everything that was necessary for me to live. And I got a cablegram that told me that I wasn't chosen for that job. You know, that's the only job I've asked for in 23 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you think you have to push the river, you don't. Wait. It isn't about what we do to advance ourselves. It's what we do to get more sober. It's what we do to get more spiritual. If you're not happy with your job, do a good eighth and ninth step. And you might say, what's that got to do with my job? If you do a good eighth and ninth step, then the job you're supposed to have will come. You know, I had this father who never told me he loved me. You know, one of those, boy, I'd had you crying in your beer if you'd have sat next to me. You know, this guy never told me he loved me. And that's what was wrong with me. If only my father had told me he loved me. And there's a lot of that going around Alcoholics Anonymous. I was telling friends, I was out in Northern California a few years ago. And I was just, you know, talking to these folks. I thought I'd say something clever, you know. And I said, you know, I hear a lot about people talking about healing the child within. I said, you know, when I was new, they told me I had to discipline a little bastard within. Well, 300 people got up and stormed out. And about half of them left their teddy bears. It was a terrible thing, you know. You know, the steps really do deal with these things. They really do. And I really had this father problem. And I think it's important. I hear a lot of guys fifth step, and a lot of guys have the father problem. And I sincerely believe, my sponsor Tom I told me this, I believe that if we don't deal with the father thing, it'll come back and bite us. And I don't think we'll ever have contented long-term sobriety if we don't deal with the father thing. Because it reflects itself in my relationship to God, my father. It reflects itself in my relationship to anybody in authority, man or woman, over me. I think I've really got to come to deal with his father thing. And I'd go home to see my father to make amends. And I'd be with him 5 minutes. And I'd get so angry, I'd get up and storm out and drive back 300 miles. And finally, my dad said to my mother, he said, you know, I'm worried about that boy. He said, he drives a long way for a cup of coffee. And you know, finally, after he retired, he'd never been on a vacation. And, you know, somebody always needed college tuition or a bicycle or a pair of shoes. And he never had a vacation. And he retired, and I had a little house down at the ocean. And my father and mother had never seen the ocean. And I said to him, I said, would you come down and keep an eye on my house for me? I have some things to do and some places to go. And they came down, and they lived at the little house, a place called CZ Desert. And they lived there for 6 years and fell in love again. And my mother learned to paint, and my father learned all about tides and walked the beach. And they were really just a cute couple. Mike used to talk about it all the time. They'd sit on a swing out on the deck overlooking the ocean, and Dad would just have his arm around Mom, and they'd just rock on the swing. And I went down to see him one day, and I said to him, I said, Dad, I've come to make amends to you. And he said to me, he said, oh, you don't need to make amends to me, son. And I didn't know why. I didn't know what it was. And he began to tell me a story. This is a guy who never loved me. And I told him, he said, remember when you got your first job? And I said, yeah, Dad. I said, I would. He said, you were 12 years old. And he said, you got a job setting pins in the bowling alley in Bridgeport. And I said, oh, yeah. I said, I remember. He said, remember your first day at work? I said, I don't think so. He said, I took you to lunch. And I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, we went to Louis's hot dog stand. He said, do you remember what you had? And I said, well, I guess I had a hot dog. And he said, yeah, he said, you had a hot dog with ketchup and onions. And I said, he said, do you remember what you drank? And I said, well, I always drank orange pop, so it was probably an orange pop. He said, no. He said, that day you drank root beer. He said, I drank root beer, and I think you thought men who work drank root beer. And he said, I explained to you what it was like to give a good day's work for a good day's pay. And then I asked you, do you want me to go on the bus with you for the first day at your job? And he said, we walked down to the bus station, and he said, I wanted to come with you. And I said, Keith, you want me to ride down there with you? And you said to me, no thanks, Dad, I'll do it myself. And he said, my 12-year-old little boy got on the bus. And he said, I watched the bus till it was out of sight, and you never looked back. And he said, from that day on, I never felt I had the right to tell you anything. And you know, in our book, it tells us that most people treat us the way we force them to treat us. And I forced my father. My grave injustice to my father was I would not allow him to father me. He said, all your brothers and sisters who went to college or whatever else they did, they always let me help them. And you never let me help you. I never felt I had a right to have anything to do with your life. And you know, when I was graduated from Paris Island, my father came down. He took a bus. He owned one suit, and it was a winter suit, a wool suit. And this was in August on Paris Island, South Carolina. And God, it was awful hot. I mean, it was over 100 degrees, and they'd run the black flag up. And there's my father, and the only suit he owns is dripping wet, soaking wet. And I have these pictures, and they took pictures of me and the colonel and my father, and there were big write-ups in the newspapers and things. And we were walking off the drill field, and my father said to me, he said, you know, if you worked this hard in college, you'd have straight A's. And I just knew he was minimizing and ridiculing what I had accomplished. And I was enraged, and I left that drill field, and I got on a bus, and I decided that I would go to the next place and prove myself. You know, many years later, my father was talking to me about that incident, and he said, you know, he said, I always knew that what you thought, what you did wasn't very good. And he said, I wanted you to know that what you did was as good as your brothers and sisters in college who got A's. And I was wrong. The listener was broken. I was wrong. And you know, Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the perfect way to deal with my mother and my father. They told me to honor them. I said, honor them. I thought honoring meant agreeing. We don't agree politically. We don't agree on much of anything. But I honor them. You know, there's a commandment that, with promise. And the promise is we'll have a long life. And I'm convinced that the only way I can ever deal well with my children is if I forgive my parents and honor them. In long life, I may not live long. But you know, my dad's 84 now. And my daughters are in their 20s, and they're married, and hopefully they'll have children. And you know, that'll be about four generations, and that's a long time. That's a long life. The eighth and ninth steps, the key to happiness in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the day came when I had to go make amends to dumb Denny. And Denny was at that time living in New Jersey, and I went to see him, and I drove up from Washington to see dumb Denny, and we began to talk, and his wife Jan knew that this was different, and she excused herself and went to bed, and we had that talk. And I said to him, I said, Den, I've come here to make amends to you. I said, all too often I have said things to you that were negative, or about you that were negative. And I said, it's because I've always envied you. And I said, I've envied your success. I've envied your determination and your single-mindedness and your single purpose. He started to laugh. He said, well, you owe me an amends, and I owe you an amends too, Keith. He said, all my life I've been afraid. He said, once I set out in a certain course, I'm afraid to change. And he said, I've always admired you, he said, because you never seem to give a shit. He said, things weren't going well in one country, you go to another country. And you know, that's really the truth. That's the way it is. And we're not better or worse, we're different. And now we're best friends. And Denny and I are best friends. We'll be together next month. We'll play in my member guest golf tournament. And then in August, I'll go out to California and play in his. And we'll just enjoy being with one another. And I'm the executor of his estate. Can you imagine that, a drunk? I can't tell you what it means to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. What I can tell you is that if you will work this program, then things will happen to you that you won't believe. And the thing that normally keeps us from working the program is that tremendous guilt. Isn't that right? The guilt. You know, the thing that just popped up in your head when we mentioned guilt. The thing that tastes bad and hurts around your heart and gives you a knot in the stomach. That's guilt. And I just wanted to say something about that. Because I know there are a lot of new folks here. And I tell you, when I was new, I was so guilty that I almost didn't live through it. I was guilty mainly about my children. And there's a man in Washington, D.C. His name is Harold. Mike knows him. And I never forget Happy Harold as long as I live. He led a meeting at my home group one night. And I was probably sober about 5 or 6 months. And Happy Harold... We used to go for coffee when it was over, and I was so obsessed with myself that particular day, and I couldn't see the children, and one thing after another, and we were at this place, and I just couldn't stop the voices in my head, and so I figured I'd just go home, and I didn't know what was going to happen to me, and I started out of this place, and Harold stopped me. He said, son, he said, come on over here. He said, I don't know you, and he said, my name's Harold, and I'm an alcoholic. He said, will you join me for a few minutes? And I sat down, and Harold... said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "Harold, I feel guilty. I said, I'm not permitted to see my children. I said, they're only 3 and 4 years old. I said, I've been a lousy father and everything." And he said, "I know about guilt." And he told me this story. He told me, he said his mother was dying, and she called him up and said she wanted all her children to come and see her the next morning. And she said, "But Harold, if you're drinking, I don't want you to come, because I don't want to go into eternity seeing my son drunk." And he said, "I showed up the next day at the hospital," and he said, "I was drunk." He said, "Of course I was drunk. I'm an alcoholic." And he said, "My brothers and sisters were there and said, 'Harold, you can't go up and see her.'" And he said, "I called up there and said, 'Mama, can I see?' And she said, 'Are you drinking, Harold?' And he said, 'Yes, I am.' And she said, 'You can't come up.' And he said, 'Well, my brothers and sisters went up to say goodbye to our mama. I sat in the waiting room, and my mama died.'" And I said, "How do you live with that?" He said, "You're going to discover, if you stay with us, that the worst thing you've ever done becomes your greatest gift." I was so overwhelmed with that. I forgot about myself for a few minutes, and I left, and I went home, and I got a good night's sleep. And about 3 months later, I was at the hospital, and I saw Harold by the elevator, and I went over and shook his hand. We talked for a few minutes, and he got on the elevator and left, and a nurse came up to me and said, "Do you know Mr. B?" And I said, "Yeah, Harold." And she said, "He's the greatest guy we know." I said, "Oh, really?" She said, "Yes." She said, "Whenever we have an old person here who doesn't have anybody and they're dying, we call Harold, and Harold comes and helps." And those words rang through my head: "The worst you've ever done will become your greatest gift." And that's the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. We can never minimize what happens here. The miraculous powers in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a gift that nobody else in the world has. For 10,000 years, alcoholism has been killing people. And in our lifetime, the solution's come along. And not only is there a solution, but we're the instrument of the solution. And that's the power. And you know, if you're sober 30 days, find someone who's sober 15 days and shake your hand and tell them that you're glad they're there. And you're going to begin to understand a little bit about the majesty of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was sober, about 3 months, and they were doing a bone marrow on a young woman. She was a beautiful woman. She was had red hair, and I'd go in there to grow the specimen. And I worked in genetics at the time, and I'll never forget her as long as I live. I remember I was struck with how pretty she was, and she said, "You know, it's not fair." She said, "I'm only 29 years old, and I have this disease." And I thought, "You know, I'm 29 years old, and I have this disease." And she said, "Because of this, my husband took our two kids and left." And I thought, "You know, because of my disease, my wife took our two kids and left." And then she said it. She said, I'd do anything if I could be well." In 30 days, she died of leukemia. And 30 days later, I was sober 4 months. And I learned that I do, through you, have the power to change the course of my life. I do not have to live in a basement of a dive in a Skid Row section of Washington, D.C. I can live on R.L. Honeycutt Drive in a nice town called Wilmington, North Carolina. And I can live a life filled with grace with a beautiful woman I married to and love very, very much. I love in ways I never knew I could love. I can pray with her. I can make love to her. I can just sit and read while she sits and reads. And we can be one. I can sponsor guys. Guys I love very, very much. A few of them I don't like. But I love them all very, very much. And you don't know what that means to me. I can have a sponsor. I can have friends. Most of all, I can have a relationship with God as I understand Him. And it's all part of this program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's all part of a willingness to be wrong about what I thought. The great gift is being wrong. I'd like to leave you with a wish. And my wish is that as you live out this life, you'll find out how very, very many times you've been wrong. How you've misjudged them and their intentions and their desires for you. But most of all, I hope that you discover how wrong you've been about God. Because the great gift to me is being wrong about God. You know, these religious people who frighten me, I put them on my eighth step list. And I went down to a little retreat center in Faulkner, Maryland, where Mike and I used to go for retreats. Every quarter we'd go down to a silent retreat. Mike could never be quiet, but I could. And I went down to find a priest to make amends to for all the spiritual people that I had ridiculed and the God I had blasphemed. And I couldn't find this guy. He was a young guy, and he was hep, and he was a theologian, and I knew he'd understand the deep significance of this humble act I was about to perform. But what I did find was an old man sitting in a rocking chair, and he was rocking back and forth, and he had a blanket over his legs, and he was reading from his breviary. And I said to him, "Father, do you have a few minutes? I'd like to talk." He said, "Well, come in, son." And I sat in a rocking chair across from him, and we rocked and talked. And I told him why I was there, and I told him how I had called people like him names, and I'd ridiculed him. And he listened to me for a little while, and I talked to him about losing my family and about going to Skid Row. And I got about halfway through, and he put the book down. I'll never forget this. And he came over, and he picked me up, and he began to pat me and hug me, and he began to cry. And he said, "I need you to stop, son." He said, "It's not you who owe me an amends, it's I who owe you one." He said, "I've got an illness that will ensure that I go to see my father soon." And he said, "I've just been sitting here asking God where I've missed it." He said, "I've been a priest for 50 years. And I wonder where I've missed it." And he said, "God sent you to me." And he reminded me that too often during these 50 years, I've agreed with the 99 who agreed with me. And I should have been out looking for the one who was lost. And he said, "I'm sorry you were out there all alone." And I discovered something about spiritual people. I discovered that spiritual people are people who do the best they can with what they have. And that's what this man always did. And you know, that's what I always did. I always did the best I had, the best I could with what I had. And there was a time I was so sick I had nothing. And I did the best I could with it. I wanted that little girl to live. So I got on my knees in front of a tabernacle and begged God to let her live. And I was drunk within 24 hours. But that's the best I could do. And God doesn't judge me on my performance. He judges me on my intentions. He knows my heart. So if you're worried about who you are or what you are, don't. Go to God, and He's going to tell you something. He's going to tell you, "I love you exactly the way you are. I'll change you. But I love you just the way you are." I moved to Fayetteville, North Carolina in 1980, and I was sitting on a balcony overlooking the lake. And I never forget this as long as I live. I was reading from the big book, in a big, big book, and I looked out, and I just was overwhelmed with gratitude. And I said, "Why me, Father? I'm sober 7 years. Why did you pick me to be sober?" And I thought back to when I went to that treatment center, I called my ex-wife. This woman had been physically and emotionally abused by me. And she answered the phone. I said, "It's me." She said, "What do you want?" I said, "I'm an alcoholic." And she said, "No shit." I said, "Why me?" She said, "Why not you? If anybody deserves it, you do." And she hung up the phone. And I was asking God, my Father, "Why me, Father?" You know what He said? He said, "Why not you, son? If anybody deserves it, you do." And that's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. He loved us so much that He gave us a program that will allow us to live. No one ever had this before. No one. One in a thousand of us got well before. Now every one of us who's willing to do a few simple things can be well. Thank God and thank you.